Good morning. I have a fun job at the CIPD. I look at drivers of change, horizon scanning, and get the opportunity to then put this into thought pieces. So let me just get, So my title is The Future Starts Here, Workforce Drivers and Disruptions. So what I do is I look at trends at a basis. So I look at what's happened in the past, what's happening now, the kinds of drivers now, and some of the polls that's coming out from the future. And when we think of the future, what is our assumption? What are our assumptions? We think that people hold our beliefs. We think tomorrow is going to be a little bit like today. We think yesterday is not really relevant. You know, everything's about AI, robotics. And we see ourselves in every future, right smack in the middle. Now, that's fine. If trends continue, that's okay. But in a period of uncertainty, none of this will hold. And in the work that I do, we look at four organizations, what are probable futures, if they're risk-averse. If they're a little bit more adventurous, we look at plausible or even possible futures, looking at some of the wild cards, some of the things that may happen, which are probably unlikely, but when they do happen, they have huge and damaging impact. Just looking at trend data, you just pull out some random demographic stuff. The global population is going to grow to nearly 10 billion in 2050. And in the UK, by 2040, you're just looking at 15 million 65-year-olds. And of that, 8.7 million and versus 8.7 million young people. And by 2034, it's estimated that 3.5 million of the population will be age 85 and above. Now, that's a lot of demands on healthcare. And where is your workforce coming from to look after these citizens? And they will be demanding. Now, one of the things that's very important in, and I thank Karen for asking the question, where do we find the space for longer term thinking? Trying to understand the interactions that's shaping our world today. And what I do is not predictions, but actually understanding the interactions of different drivers and what possible futures could emerge from that. This is a chart done by the World Economic Forum, and they're looking at the drivers shaping workforce and employment going forward. So workforce and employment in their model is going to be mediated by new work models, disruption to jobs and skills, the nature of inclusion in labor markets, social protection models, training and certification systems, and the labor market demographics, which we touched on a little bit earlier. So these things are the things that's going to mediate the availability and the quality of the workforce and the nature of employment going forward. But if you look around on the outer circle, this is also affected by other drivers, like the perspectives of the youth, huge economies like what's going to happen in China, Nigeria, India. It's going to be looking at the kinds of values that people are going to hold in the future or the fragmentation of those futures, of those values. It's going to look at how we look at migration, whether that's even possible to control. It's going to look at the nature of media and how that shapes expectations and so on. Now, I pulled this out from the World Economic Forum because they have a systemic view of the future of health and healthcare. And I just pulled up the particular connections for healthcare technology as the mediator shaping that future. And you will see from this chart that they are looking at the impact of advanced materials, biotechnology, 3D printing, artificial intelligence and robotics, not surprising, the chemical industry and materials, the future of food, what is how that's going to interact with health, how the fourth industrial revolution unfolds, as well as precision medicine, and how you use that knowledge the genomic technology you have for individuals in delivery of your healthcare. Now, all of these are all very good, and it's very hard for anyone who's doing planning to begin to grapple with so many moving parts and how these moving parts interact at different levels, at different times. So what we do is, in my field, we begin to pull some of these together, prioritize, dial up some things, dial down some things, and create scenarios. Now, scenarios are not predictions. They are a way of thinking about the future and the red flags that come with it, and then the possibility of building a contingency response. So this is something I did for the Singapore government a few years ago when they wanted a way of thinking about national workforce planning. How does the government create policies in education, in skills, in migration, in the way that they do curricula, in the way that they do an offering to international talent to plug in some of the gaps, but also to signal to their citizens what kinds of areas will be fruitful for them to invest in to have a career in 10 years' time. So this is online, you can pick it up, and I just published one for the Malaysian government looking at skills going into 2035. And these are governments who use their centralized planning levers to try to signal to the market, not that they can do everything, but they signal to the market, to private sector, to the civil service, these are the things we need to think about, and these are the things you need to consider, these are the things that the university should begin to plan for in their curricula of the future. Now, just this week, and I apologize to Phil Wright for delivering the slides very late because I was actually reading the brand new report coming out from the RSA on the future of work 2035. And it looks very carefully at some of the drivers shaping the UK labour market. But what they focus in that report, and it's quite an interesting one, is technology, the role that technology companies, and how this is shaping could shape the economy going forward. So in their four scenarios, they looked at the big tech economy, where basically you have a kind of capture. The big tech companies are so dominant that, you know, companies, organizations, governments are captured by these platforms, and you actually have to bow down to their particular economic dominance in that economy. And this is not an unusual situation. That kind of capture is quite common. How many of you have been following the 737 MAX story, and how the last regulator to start to ground the plane was the FAA. Now, the FAA, if you look at some of the documentaries about the way that it works with industry, it's captured by industry. They are populated by a lot of Boeing executives, and they farm out a lot of the regulatory functions to self-regulators at Boeing. So there is every reason for them to not ground a Boeing plane. And if we think about the nature of Google and all these companies and the capture they have on data, that can go the same way. Just like the NHS is being courted by certain companies to release data. That data is priceless. Whoever controls that data can do capture. The precision economy, the second scenario, looks at how technology is used in measurement and capture of people data. So, you know, when we start wearing Fitbits, when we start wearing other forms of technology, some of it being sold here, that data goes somewhere. Somebody owns that data. Thanks to GDPR, it's technically ours, but do we really know what that means? So the precision economy is one where everything is measured, everything is analyzed, and then services are then churned out for you. But the things that you need to think about is that as a worker, you are also being, the level of surveillance is quite intense. So it's not just you clocking in and out. They're capturing physiological data. They're capturing your sleep patterns. they're capturing whether you're too stressed to make a particular decision. All right, so there are questions about privacy, there are questions about intrusion, but there's also a productivity pressure on that kind of economy. Then we had the exodus economy. We talked about having hundreds of thousands of vacancies in this country, in the health sector. But that's predicated on somebody footing the bill. Can we continue to foot the bill? Question mark. And then this scenario, they talk, they explore a world where there's high unemployment, where contingent workforce is the norm. Because of a global slowdown, there's a fiscal crisis, not just in the UK, but in many developed countries. And that leads to less investment in automation and so on. We're back to a low-skill, low-paid, low-productivity economy. And people then begin to have to make really hard choices about exiting the cities, maybe moving to regions, maybe leaving the country. In the last scenario, they talked about the tech promise being realized. So all the promises that the technologies tell you actually happen. We have autonomous vehicles, we have artificial intelligence that works, we have robots taking away all the hard and difficult and dirty jobs, and we have more and more platformed economy. So in that scenario, they talk about how jobs are disintermediated for the middle classes. And as you can see, there are a lot of professional jobs being changed. If you look at law firms nowadays, a lot of the grunt work that junior lawyers would do, the kind of case study, you know, looking for cases, actually preparing cases by going through Lexis, that can be done automatically now. And in the medical field, of course, you know, the equivalent will be Watson, where the diagnostics is done by artificial intelligence, and then you do the value added at the end. Of course, now there's big question mark about Watson, given that it's given pretty poor recommendations to some oncologists. And a lot of hospitals in the US have now declined to use Watson. So, but that will get better over time. And then in this scenario, there's a tech capture, but the technology companies are a little bit smarter. They moderate the effects of that capture. They do self-regulation. And what has happened is the growth is in high-touch, personalized jobs. The question there is, what effect does that have on the welfare of those people working in those personalized jobs? Counseling, personal care, scheduling, and so on. In this scenario, they explore how this evolves, and what happens is, in order to succeed in this personalized sector, you have to be on brand 24/7, regardless of your mental health situation. And that is the kind of economy in the empathy quadrant there. Now, in this report, there was also a discussion about how technology is adopted. And we tend to use it as a kind of blanket thing that, you know, technology will be adopted this way or that way. But as you know, technology is not universally or evenly distributed, nor is it welcomed or easily adopted. It depends on a lot of other factors. So in automation, you have, of course, different effects. You have substitution, you have augmentation, so I'm supported by in surgery, you have automation of certain functions so that you can actually get on to do other things. There's generation where you have machines doing work that's not already done by a human being. And the example given in that report was monitoring monitoring salmon in their cages for lice. And that is, at the moment, just treated with chemicals. It is not monitored by any human eye. But there are actually machines doing that now to increase productivity. And there's also, of course, fake automation. How many of you have used automated checkout? Right? Sainsbury, Tesco, so on. That's not real automation. That's just making sure that you do the work that they ought to be doing. right? It's shifting of costs. There's very little kind of productivity gain there, because at the end of the day, if you cost the amount of time you have to kind of wait around, go, excuse me, can you? Yeah, that's time. That's your time. That's lost productivity. Then there's brokerage. So brokerage means the kind of intermediation. So you have platforms to do it. So how many of you remember Craigslist? No? Yeah, okay, great. So Craigslist was the original online platform where if you had a pram to sell or you had gardening services, whatever, you could just put it on Craigslist. And of course, now that's been superseded by eBay and Uber. Anything that captures underutilized resources. And now we have, of course, scheduling software. Some of it is on offer here in pursuit of efficiency. The downside of that is that, unchecked, you have work intensification. There is push for wages downwards. And there's a potential for lower labor protection as we become more and more platformed. Unless, you know, you have a government that isn't captured, who's prepared to regulate for more labor protection for this particular form of work. Then there's digitization, you know, which we're exploring today. The nature of digitization is that everything is commodifiable. Music, film, books, news, even love and sex is commodified in this digital world. What it does is, of course, it lowers all the human administration costs. It's more efficient, you know, in terms of matching needs. But it also creates the potential for networked monopolies. So when an organization like the NHS begins to invest in digitization, this is something that you have to take into account, that inadvertently you could create really unhelpful monopolies that may be very, very productive and very efficient, which then leads to data capture, concentration of power, and then losing control over the beast that you've created. And then management. So we are managing human capital here. Surveillance. Now we are looking at people's location. We're looking at their physiological condition. We're looking at very detailed supervision of our workforce. Now, there is a limit to that, we hope. But the thing about this kind of data is that it's extremely valuable, because at a certain level, it lends itself to predictive analytics. However, it also sits within an environment, an ecosystem of false promises, fake news, and employee resistances, sometimes justified and sometimes completely incomprehensible because of this environment. So some of the implications of what I've just said. So we've talked about different ways in which technology is adopted or not adopted, the kind of outcome and impact of technology adoption, as well as some of the scenarios that the RSA has explored. So when we think about technology adoption, while it has positive impact on productivity, does it have negative systemic or workforce implications? You need to think about that, because people are not going to use or adopt those technologies going forward. And as a public organization, the level of accountability downstream, because as we all know, we can be judged by the standards of the future. And you will be judged by the standards of the future by your choices today. There are issues about privacy, as I talked about it, de-skilling. Some technologies actually de-skill your workforce. There is unemployment and underemployment in certain sectors. Some with capture become anti-competitive. And what the RSA, not surprisingly, recommends is that we have a charter for ethical technology investments. If we're going to put money into this, especially public money, it must be ethically screened for long-term impact. So if you look at some of the issues that the scenarios bring, ethics comes very, very high on that list. And in the European Commission recommendations, priorities for digitization, data protection, data security, but secure data transfer is on that list. And one of the things that they're prioritizing for digitization of healthcare is to increase and strengthen the voice of the citizen in the choices being made in the shaping of the ecosystem for healthcare. And the Estonia one is an example of where the European Commission is building that voice and educating that voice so that there is a check and balance to the onward rush towards adoption of AI. And there are bigger questions about the social contract between the state, citizen, and patient. So just to add to the kinds of things that you will have to think about long term, there is the global economy, whether or not we can afford any of this. There are inequalities, which we know are acute, between London regions, between region and region, between family and family. These inequalities are explosive, and managing them is important because it will impact your ability to deliver. Migration, you know, it's a big European problem, but it's not just a European problem, it's a global one. We will have lots and lots of population growth in Africa, and lots of declining birth rates in the whole of continental Europe. So merely saying we're going to stop migration isn't a sensible way to have that conversation. Then there is market concentration. There is the nature of citizen voice, which can morph. We can see how that voice is fragmenting and changing because of social media. New technologies will change the way that that voice is refracted, and that will affect the nature of delivery. And of course, how we think of work. If there is work, what that work means as a meaningful part of our lives. So this is just part of another lecture, but this is just to tell you that this kind of workforce planning tools are already present. I mean, this is today. And the reason I show this is because this organization I work with in Australia, they do scenario planning within their workforce strategy. The software allows them to look at alternate models. And actually what it does is, whilst they're focusing on priorities like D&I and so on, they're able to then see, you know, what is the current mix, how do they want the optimal mix to be, and assuming that you have a pipeline of talent, how are you going to fill it? And a kind of three-year plan to build that. But also forcing you to think about alternate sources of talent. So one of the things that the creator of this page told me was they were trying to get quantitatively skilled workers to do data crunching, and they couldn't find enough data scientists. So what he did was he said, let me break down the competencies required for these jobs that I have. And he found that actually he could poach estate agents who were actually doing things like looking at prices, locations. So they understood modeling. And he managed to bring them on, skill them up, and he had a new source of talent for those vacancies. And because he could see that there was no way he could fulfill his plan, you know, as HRD, he had to go around thinking, okay, how do I decompose this? How do I begin to find other sectors to poach? Okay, and this is just, as you know, a heat map, just to see where the risks are going forward against your workforce scenario. And this is not unfamiliar to any of you, I'm sure, in terms of your analytics trajectory. One kind of learning I took away from a recent conference was, you know, we talk about the maturity for analytics and how you move from descriptive to insight into predictive and so on. What I learned at this conference, and it made sense after he said it, was that certain parts of your organization really just need the descriptive. Certain parts are mature enough to derive insights because they're thinking that way. They're asking those questions. And certain parts require the predictive. But actually, for a mature model to work, you need all of this. You need to be able, as an analytics function within your organization, to be able to do descriptive, insight and predictive analytics, as well as innovation at the other end. Is that how does this data help you in the investments going forward? And if your analytics are really good enough, this would be the holy grail. So if I showed you this, you'd be able to understand what your workforce is thinking and feeling. Now, that's a bit scary, right? But yes, that's the holy grail of analytics. And I just leave you with this quote: the greatest obstacle to discovery is not ignorance, but the illusion of knowledge. So as we pursue data digitization and analytics and making decisions, let's not forget that we must actually be a little bit smart about this and not just be carried away by those numbers. And in any case, if you Google this, whilst this quote is attributed to my learned friend up there, actually, in Google, it is also attributed to a US Library of Congress librarian. So, am I spreading fake news? Thank you.